When you live in turbulent times and powerful emotions are provoked, people who are in a position to have access to the public eyes and ears tend to get a similar idea. And the idea is simply this, that they are moved in one direction or another by what's happening, and they want to talk about it. Their main job, the main reason that they are before the public, may have nothing to do with the times or the issues that they are motivated to speak about, but nonetheless, they have the stage, and that's how they choose to use it. This is not new, and it is not surprising. Maybe one Christmas you've heard this song from 1971 on the radio.
So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone.
The really original idea in this song, which will be sung momentarily by the Harlem Community Choir, didn't begin as a song lyric. It began as a series of billboards. They went up in December 1969 in New York, Los Angeles, Toronto, Rome, Athens, Amsterdam, Berlin, Paris, London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Helsinki. They were black and white, and they said in big letters, "War is over," then in smaller print, "If you want it." And below that, in still smaller print yet, it said, "Happy Christmas," from John and Yoko.
So this is Christmas, for weak and for strong, the rich and the poor ones, the world is so long, and so.
The part of this that no one ever talks about is that John Lennon and Yoko Ono were nearly beaten to this kind of gesture by Tom Seaver, the ace of the New York Mets. The Mets were, quite miraculously, in the World Series that year, playing the Baltimore Orioles, and the day before the series started, United Press International released this dispatch. Tom Seaver, the New York Mets starting pitcher for the opening World Series game here tomorrow, believes the United States should get out of Vietnam. He says he plans to buy an advertisement in the New York Times saying, "If the Mets can win the World Series, then we can get out of Vietnam." The Mets would have to defeat the Baltimore Orioles before Seaver could place such an ad, but the 24-year-old Californian, who electrified the baseball world by winning 25 games for the Mets, helping them to the National League pennant, thinks he can carry out the plan in any case. Quote, "I think it's perfectly ridiculous what we're doing about the Vietnam situation. It's absurd. When the series is over, I'm going to have a talk with Ted Kennedy, convey some of my ideas to him, and then take an ad in the paper. I feel very strongly about this." That Seaver had chosen this moment to make this statement wasn't denied by him exactly, but when reporters tried to follow up on it with him, he simply said, "I don't want to be used for political purposes." And with that, he went off and pitched game one. And I don't know whether he really said it or didn't, but the sentiment was consistent with things that he had said on other occasions. Talking about some off-season educational work that he did, Seaver, who was a reservist in the Marine Corps, said that in a class on argument, he had taken the con side in the Vietnam controversy. "I took the view that it's the wrong war. It's basically a civil war and a guerrilla war, but now we are committed too deep and at an ungodly cost." At the same time, he didn't want to change anyone's mind just because he was a ball player. He said after the World Series, "I don't know if people can look at me and say, there's a human being, not just a baseball player. Something as important as our involvement in Southeast Asia should be judged without emotional involvement. It would be very wrong for people to look at me and become involved about 18-year-old young men losing their legs and their lives, about a 4-year-old baby who never saw his father because he's a prisoner of war. If someone came to the right conclusion about the war because he was emotionally involved with me, the ball player, I don't think that would be right." And Seaver never did buy a billboard. And yet, well, on December 31st, 1969, on page 30 of the New York Times, the second sports page, just below an ad for The Burlington ski lift route of Mohawk Airlines is a small box. It's not even an eighth of a page. It, too, is black type on a white background. And it says, on the eve of 1970, please join us in a prayer for peace. And in smaller font, Nancy and Tom Seaver. Asked about this later, Seaver said, Nancy and I thought about placing the ad for quite a while, and we finally did it because we thought, what can we tell our kids 20 years from now we did to help save some lives? We want to have something to show 20 years from now. And so the idea that people have the stage will want to use the stage for what they perceive as positive purposes is not a new one. And though you may find their words intrusive, you don't want to silence those people, because war is over if you want it. And a prayer for peace may be the first verbalization, the first solidification of that thought in your mind and the minds of so many others. And that prayer becomes the seed crystal that stops a terrible and pointless atrocity from happening. There's always a first time, and it may not have to come from one of the Beatles. Could be a pitcher, too. A terrific one. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Interested in Georgie. He had pimples and he smelled of fish, but when he said he had front row tickets to the Bay City Rollers show, you agreed to go out with him. It was only when you arrived at the venue itself that he confessed that he didn't have the tickets, never had them in the first place. It's just that I really liked you, Betty Lou, and this was the only way I could think of to get you to go out with me. Even if I don't have the tickets, I do have Episode 23. Someday, you will tell your grandchildren that you knew in that moment you would marry him, but that's not the truth. The truth is, his body has never been found. Next time, you'll hold out for the Bee Gees. Welcome back to the show. It is my distinct pleasure and honor to be speaking with you again. This week, I'm joined by Mary Craig, who writes for Baseball Prospectus and Beyond the Box Score over at SB Nation. And her focus as a doctoral candidate in political theory and history is the intersection between baseball and politics. And I have to confess to you that I asked her to come on well over 10 days before the President of the United States decided to show the world once and for all that stick to sports is freaking impossible. It was just through his good offices, so to speak, that our conversation became ridiculously timely. And of course, we don't talk about just that. We cover not only current controversies, but some older ones that afflicted the game, and also some even older issues because one of her areas of focus is the American founding, which means exactly what it sounds like. Those enduringly fascinating, weird, creative, amazing, intelligent, perverted dudes in the wigs and breeches and stockings. They never cease to amaze and they never cease to disappoint, and that's their value. So we talk about that quite a bit. Before she joins me, though, I would like to carry on with a tale in an adjacent vein to the one that I brought you in our opening. It's a story of the 31st president. Herbert Hoover loved baseball, but baseball didn't always love Herbert Hoover back. It began when he ran for president the first time in 1928. It must have seemed like one of those elections that are supposedly about nothing. Some of you will remember that in 2000, the contest between George W. Bush and Al Gore was deemed an election about nothing, but it wasn't, and by September 11th, 2001, it became painfully obvious that it hadn't been about nothing. Well, in 1928, World War I was 10 years in the background. The economy was, as far as anybody knew, cooking along at a really high level. Calvin Coolidge, the incumbent, was incredibly popular, and there was nothing really stopping him from going for a third term. Remember, there was no constitutional amendment then preventing a president from running for extra terms indefinitely. Coolidge had finished out Warren Harding's term after he died in office and then had one of his own, and although he was pretty much the anti-personality president, Theodore Roosevelt's daughter said that he looked as if he had been weaned on a pickle, he could have won again, and he probably wanted to run again, but he was waiting to be drafted, and somehow it just didn't happen. Instead, the Republicans nominated his Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, a guy Coolidge really didn't like. The Democrats, in the way that Democrats have, nominated Governor Al Smith of New York. Now, Al Smith had a lot going for him, but in terms of national electability, the Democrats managed to nominate an Irish Catholic at the height of anti-Catholic fervor. The Klan had made a comeback based more on their hatred of Catholics and Jews than on their traditional hatred of African Americans, and had won the state government of Indiana, and were pretty powerful in Oregon, too, which always surprises me to hear about it. Smith was also from New York City at a time of great anti-urbanism. And he was a Wed, meaning that he favored the abolition of prohibition at a time when a good chunk of the country was still enjoying the fact that they couldn't have a drink. Hoover was dry. So since I'm going to hit the theme, nothing ever changes, and less is new than you think it is several times today, I might as well start now by noting the Democratic Party's usual hypercompetence and great sense of timing in choosing their candidates, reinforcing the idea that it was an election about nothing. Neither party did a lot of thinking in terms of formulating their platforms that year. The Republican platform was basically, if you like the way things are under Coolidge, elect Hoover. He won't change anything. He's the great engineer. He was, too. He was a mining engineer. And he'll tinker with the economic machine to keep it functioning at the same high level that you're used to. The Democratic platform was basically, we'll do whatever they did that's working, don't worry about it, but maybe we could have a drink now and then? They really didn't do a whole lot to distinguish themselves. Again, nothing changes. Nevertheless, Hoover's looking for an edge because you can't take anything for granted, and he wasn't Mr. Personality either, so it was a challenge trying to present him in a human light. On September 1st, 1928, he goes to Griffith Stadium in Washington, D.C. to see the New York Yankees play the Washington Senators. He picked a pretty cool day to go, too. The place was just crawling with future Hall of Famers. In addition to Senators owner Clark Griffith and Yankees manager Miller Huggins, who were not exactly on the field, the starting lineups included, on the Yankees side, Earl Coombs, Lou Gehrig, Babe Ruth, Leo Durocher, who would later go in as a manager, and Waite Hoyt, who came into the game in relief. On the Senators' side, there was Sam Rice and Goose Goslin in the outfield. Bucky Harris was playing second base. He also went in as a manager. And Joe Cronin, who was just starting out with the Senators then, came in as a defensive replacement at shortstop. As the players are warming up before the game, a photographer working for Hoover gets a great idea. Hoover can have his picture taken with Babe Ruth, biggest star in the country, basically, at that moment, less than a year removed from setting a record with 60 home runs and on his way to another 54 in 28. And so Hoover, or Hoover's photographer, asks, via Clark Griffith, if Ruth will come over and pose shaking hands with the candidate. Ruth says no. Griffith quoted him as saying, "It's a matter of politics." That was a paraphrase, though. What he actually said was something more like, "Nothing doing on politics. Besides, I'm for Smith." Supposedly, he also said, "Tell him I'll be glad to talk to him if he wants to meet me under the stands." Then they went and they played the game, and in the sixth inning, the fans had a riot because a Senators pinch runner, the pitcher Sad Sam Jones, was called out for being hit by a batted ball, thus killing a Senators rally. In the end, Hoover ducked some bottles. Senators shortstop Bobby Reeves made his 42nd error of the season, which explains why Cronin came in replacement of him later, and the Yankees won 8-3, four of those runs being unearned. Thank you, Bobby Reeves. The one thing Hoover didn't get was a picture. Well, Ruth's words were reported, with the Republican-leaning population among those who were supporting Ruth through endorsements and ghosted newspaper columns. Ruth's business manager, Christy Walsh, quickly arranged for him to make a statement of apology. This is what Ruth supposedly said, as reported in the newspapers. When the photographer asked me to go to Mr. Hoover's box yesterday, I labored under a misunderstanding and deeply regret that I did not avail myself of the opportunity of meeting him. I hope Mr. Hoover will be gracious enough at some future time to permit me to present myself to him. The babe did not say that. It's not just me doing a funny voice. Hoover accepted Ruth's apology and said, I learned of the incident only from the papers. I certainly can sympathize with Babe Ruth for not wanting to hold up the game for more photographs. As an earnest baseball devotee, I long have admired Babe Ruth's batting ability, and I look forward with pleasure to meeting him. This is what we call, for everyone involved, saving face. The incident didn't hurt Hoover any at the polls. That November, he slaughtered Smith, winning 58.2% to 40.8%, taking 21.4 million popular votes to Smith's 15 million, and winning 444 electoral votes to Smith's 87, and no, Smith didn't even take New York. A few years later, there would be no saving face for Herbert Hoover. The economy had crashed hard worldwide. That wasn't his fault. And although he didn't get a lot of credit at the time, he did a lot to try to rejuvenate the economy, although he was handicapped by the economic doctrine of the time, which had him doing all the wrong things. For example, he raised taxes at the same time that the U.S. was raising tariffs and the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. Essentially, they just sucked what little money was in the economy out of it completely. He later figured out, though, that some pump priming was necessary, the reinjection of capital into the economy, and he started something called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was in some ways no different from what the New Deal would do later, or what Barack Obama did when he was elected after the economic crisis of 2008. The problem, from the point of view of people who were living under Herbert Hoover, was that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation existed to give loans to banks, to railroads, to corporations, not to people, and there were 10 million unemployed. 30% of the workforce, although 50% was at least underemployed. Hoover said no one had starved, but people had starved. It was a miserable, miserable time, and he seemed unable to react to it. He believed the federal government had no business helping people directly, that that was for communities and charities and done through the goodwill of people locally. He couldn't get his head around the idea that in a crisis so huge, only a wallet as big as the government's could help. And when the Congress tried to pass bills that provided for some kind of direct assistance, not to companies, but to people, he vetoed those bills. And so he became hated, and he couldn't really go anywhere. He locked himself in the White House and, for the most part, didn't see anybody but Boy Scouts and other people that were unlikely to criticize him or look at him askance. Still, he loved baseball, he liked throwing out first pitches, and he had become a Philadelphia A's fan, and the World Series was on. So on October 5th, 1931, he and his wife and the Secretary of the Navy and a few other potentates trained up to Philadelphia to catch Game 3 of the World Series. The president knew it wasn't a great idea to go. In his memoirs, he recalled, "Although I like baseball, I kept this engagement only because I felt that my presence at a sporting event might be a gesture of reassurance to a country suffering from a severe attack of jitters." Well, not so much, actually. First of all, he botched the first pitch. It went over Mickey Cochrane's head and was fielded by the umpire. And as the game went on, booing could be heard from the stands, and then a chant. But the chant wasn't perhaps what you might have expected. You might think in what was pretty much the floor of the Great Depression that the fans and the stands would have chanted, "We want jobs." But of course they had bought tickets, so they had money. Maybe they were some of the ones who had jobs. It wasn't work they were after. They were thirsty. What they chanted was, "Beer, beer, we want beer." Remember when I said Hoover was a dry? One columnist covering the game said, "Hey, the Philadelphians must be bored of wine and whiskey." Hoover left the game early. He also left the White House early, being defeated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the election of 1932, worse than he beat out Smith. So you see, protest at a sporting event is not exactly new. Respect is earned, regardless of what your title is, and Philadelphia was and is a tough place to come out of hiding. P.S. The A's lost. Like I said, nothing ever changes. Oh, and one other thing. The political life of this nation is our blood, and it courses through everything we do. We were founded in it. And when even as disinterested a personage as Babe Ruth says, "Nothing doing on politics," he's lying to you. I'll be back with Mary Craig in just a moment. If you Google Mary Craig, the search engine will suggest that you look at Mary Craig, Gentle Goodbye. And I wondered if that was some emotional essay that my next guest had written and I had missed. But no, it was a different Mary Craig, a veterinarian who euthanizes pets. And all I can say is, Mary, if you are actually that Mary Craig, please don't take my cats.
I'll do my best.
Oh, thank you. As I understand it, you will someday be Dr. Mary Craig, like that other Mary Craig. What is your area of study?
So I'm doing my PhD in political theory, which is the history of political thought, as well as the American founding, which is the founding of America.
So that sounds more like a purely historical topic as opposed to the other one, which is a little more abstract. How do those fit together?
They're both kind of a blend of history and theory. The American founding has a lot of political philosophy influences in it. So you kind of get a nice blend of the two. And in undergrad, I double majored in history and political science. So it's just kind of a nice combination of those two things.
So we can expect a lot of books from you, and not just about baseball, but Locke and Hobbes and Descartes and guys like that.
Yeah. I was just reading Locke's Second Treatise this morning.
You know, Locke, this will not be interesting, I think, to the vast majority of people. But for those that know, John Locke was an Enlightenment philosopher who was a great influence on our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson in particular. But I was very disappointed to learn that he was also, in addition to being somebody who talked about natural rights and the rights that men had under governments as opposed to in a state of nature, that he was also a hell of a racist. And I was just, I mean, you can't judge people by today's standards. And this was a guy who lived, what, late 1600s, early 1700s, something like that. But I was so disappointed because he was so ahead of his time in some ways and apparently wasn't in other ways.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Probably not great that he was such a racist, but definitely very interesting, especially when he was such a proponent of women's rights, or at least, you know, women's rights in that time. He was very critical of the idea of having paternal lines in the family. He railed against the patriarchy a lot. So it's an interesting, if somewhat a little disappointing and sort of hypocritical mix.
That's kind of to just talk generally about history for one more second. And this applies to baseball, too. Unfortunately, no one is all one thing. And this is something that has come up a lot recently when we've been talking about tearing down statues and how to regard certain divisive figures from the past, and the president and other people on his side saying, well, what are you going to do now? Tear down Washington's statue or Lincoln's statues because they weren't ideologically pure? The thing is that no one, sometimes not even the people that you would consider really bad guys, are 100% one way or the other. And I really think that the value of historical figures and heroes is to disappoint you in a way, to teach you not to worship blindly, but to understand that even the best among us are greatly imperfect in some aspects of their lives.
I definitely agree with that. And I think it's also what makes it difficult, but what makes it interesting and rewarding to have these figures and to have so much of their lives laid out and to try and piece together how they actually lived with their ideas of government, of human nature, and to just kind of see whether we can extract from them actual legitimate ideas that are separate and are true and can stand apart from their racism or their sexism. And then you get guys like Martin Heidegger, where it becomes a little more difficult to do that.
Oh, yes, it does. It really, really does.
Yes, it does. And a lot of people still love Heidegger, but it's a little dicey, and I always kind of like side-eye those people a little bit, because you can't so much separate his philosophy from him being a Nazi, but a lot of people try to do that. So it's just kind of an interesting way that people look at these thinkers' lives.
And that gets really complicated, too, because Heidegger had a long relationship with Hannah Arendt, who is commenting famously on Nazis later. And so everything gets really mixed and intermingled, and motives are impure. And, you know, these are hard things to evaluate. So then when we want to turn around and assign people to neat categories, it's very hard to do. I mean, I think I'm willing to make an exception. I know I'm willing to make an exception for fascism or Nazism in general. But anything shy of that, it's almost you have to take the good with the bad.
Yeah, you really do. And it's just so weird in his case, because he had all of these Nazi ideas. And I guess it kind of goes along with the idea that people who are racist and people who are misogynistic can have Black people they consider friends, or they can be close with women. And it's the same thing for him, because he did a lot of work to rescue Jewish people from persecution and to send them off to America or to France or to England before they could be rounded up.
So to backtrack for a moment, I first noticed your work via two pieces at Beyond the Box Score, and I should say you're also at Baseball Prospectus as well. And it's always neat when there's a writer that you're unaware of, and then suddenly you notice their work and they kind of spring fully formed on your consciousness, whereas in reality, they in their lives have been working up to this point for however long they've been around, and then they just start hitting balls out of the park, and this is the first time you've seen them. But there were two pieces that really made me aware of you. One was Baseball's Tumultuous Relationship with Female Fans on June 23rd of this year, and The Myth of Baseball's Depoliticization from August 23rd. And I realized, here's someone working my side of the street. Fortunately, we're not rival drug dealers. We are writers. So it's always welcome to have somebody over there. And I think that the events of the last few days, we are talking on the Sunday after a series of days in which the president called out Colin Kaepernick as a son of a bitch, and then there was a counter-reaction from various figures in sports, culminating today with many football teams not coming out for the national anthem, or some of them taking a knee or locking arms in gestures of solidarity, all of which was very moving. And somewhere in there, the Golden State Warriors also got uninvited to the White House. I think if I can sum up your story on the myth of baseball's depoliticization, it really goes to this subject. If I understand what you were trying to say, it's not that baseball has ever been apolitical, or that baseball figures have ever been apolitical. It's that they're apolitical in one direction, which is to say that if they want to support the establishment, great. If they want to go in for big displays of nationalism or support of whatever war is going on at the present time, great. But when it comes to being critical of the establishment, then it's supposed to be depolitical. And then everybody talks about sticking to sports. There's a double standard at work there.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think this is kind of where my political theory background informs my understanding of baseball. But I really believe that whenever there are human beings involved in something, it's automatically political. You can't separate the human being from politics. And people try to do that, especially when it comes to sports. And there's so much of the idea that you know, following the regime or following blind patriotism or nationalism is not political. And you only become political when you start to question these things. And I think that's very dangerous assumptions to make. The danger of them falls back on the people who are not as protected under patriotism and under nationalism. And so you just reinforcement of the way that America has ordered itself, you know, since it was created as a country, where you have white people at the top and everybody else struggling along at the bottom. And sports really kind of became a way that these people could start to make a name for themselves, and they could start to display that they had these talents and that they were more than just, you know, former slaves or what have you. And so I think to kind of erase all of that history really does a detriment to these people.
It's interesting, too. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that the banning of African Americans from baseball happened at exactly the same moment as Plessy versus Ferguson and other post-Reconstruction laws that were designed to reinstate the status of the minority population prior to the Civil War, and the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments undoing their status as not just second-class citizens, but non-citizens. and that this was just a tiny little example, Moses Fleetwood Walker being kicked out of baseball by Cap Anson and company. It was just an instance of this bigger thing that happened in the country, but it's an example of what you were just talking about.
Yeah, that definitely speaks to it. There was really a movement to erase Black people from every sort of prominent area of life. And that really became apparent in baseball, which was becoming America's sport. And so there was a lot of focus on how it was trying to become a gentleman's game. And then banning Black people, of course, says to everybody that Black people aren't gentlemen, that they don't belong in the same place as these white people. And then that becomes reinforced with what became legislation out of Plessy v. Ferguson and all of those pieces. And so you really had this reclamation of slavery across the country. It wasn't just limited to the South, as a lot of people like to believe. And there was really this idea that, okay, Black people might no longer physically be titled slaves, but we can enslave them in a lot of other ways.
So given what we're talking about, what is your perspective on the events of the last few days and how we should regard sports? Should sports be a safe zone for people? Or, you know, some people will say they just want to watch the game. They don't want to think about anything else. They just want it to be mindless entertainment for them. Or is this something where, given that the President of the United States keeps invoking himself into that frame of reference, that people who feel that way have to just admit that that's not possible, not realistic, and for that matter, that they're not owed that exactly?
As we've said earlier already, sports have never been free of politics. It's impossible for sports to be free of politics. And I think it's becoming more apparent that that's the case when you have the president railing against sports and railing against athletes. There really is this bubble being burst that a lot of people are now coming out into light and starting to understand that sports are at least somewhat political. And that goes against a lot of what they thought of sports, where it's kind of been a refuge from the hardships of their lives or whatever, that they can just put on, you know, a football game or a baseball game and get lost in it for the next 3 hours, which is fine for those people. And I think that sports can help a lot of people deal with the problems in their lives. But it's unfair for these people involved in sports to say to them that, oh, no, like, get your politics out of this. That becomes really dangerous for people to assume that anybody who tries to bring up politics into sports is just trying to stir up some fuss that, you know, they can deal with some other time when it's their lives and they have to use this platform that they've, you know, spent the last 150 years earning to try and make a change that is going to reverberate across the country. And it's going to help themselves and their friends and their families for generations to come.
It's an interesting almost creation of a separate class of people. And it may not even be based along racial or economic lines. And what I mean by that is you or I as writers, if we have a platform that will publish us and we have an opinion we want to share, we can go out and publish something. And then it's on us to persuade the reader, but we have that opportunity. If Jimmy Kimmel wants to talk about the healthcare law, he has his monologue to do that. And of course, all the various people who have shows on Fox or MSNBC or Meet the Press or anything like that, they have that window in which to speak. These athletes also have a platform, also have a window, and it's that 3 hours that you just mentioned. And where else are they going to be heard? Where else will they get to represent their feelings in this republic except during that window? And so if you say that they don't have the right to say that or they're somehow intruding on you, you are, and this is what I mean by creating a class, you're making a group of people and saying, speak when spoken to. Stay only on the subjects that we want to hear you speak about. You are merely there to hit, run, and catch the ball, whatever the sport, and we don't want to hear from you otherwise.
Precisely. And I think it's easy for people who kind of live in the same bubble that we live in, who are on Twitter and who see these athletes sending out political tweets or posting political things on Instagram to then say, okay, well, they, you know, got their politics out of the way with on their own time. They like tweeted after the game or whatever. So why need to bring it into the game itself? But there are so many people who aren't privy to these tweets or to these Instagram posts who would either benefit directly from the messages that these athletes are sending or who could have their eyes open to the idea that baseball is political and that these athletes do have a right to speak from this platform that they possess. So I think it is very important for athletes to bring politics directly into the games themselves and to use that platform as well as any sort of other post-game interviews or tweets or whatever else to get their message across.
And it's a more powerful statement in some ways than just the words that other people can bring to it. And it gets to the very visceral power of those symbols in the first place, be it the flag or be it the national anthem. Obviously, people react very strongly to that. It's the same reason that people get upset by flag burning, or you might remember the, I'm afraid this might be before your time, but the incident when Roseanne Barr completely botched the singing of the national anthem at a Padres game and then grabbed her crotch and walked off. Like, it's funny, but people also don't want to see these things that they've been taught to revere treated with less than the utmost respect. And I don't necessarily disagree that those things are to be respected, because I believe that we should have cohesion as a community. But at the same time, there is a value in questioning. And if those symbols can't withstand the answer to the question, then they don't have the value that you had intuited to them.
Mm-hmm. And especially when you look at baseball and the national anthem, when it was brought into baseball to serve as specifically a political tool during World War I to bolster patriotism. And then to say today that people don't have the right to question its role in the game is kind of hypocritical and absurd to me.
There's an aspect of sort of retroactive homogenizing that happens, right? When I learned about the Revolutionary War, the general scholarly thought about the way that support for the revolution broke down was that about a third of Americans were pro-British, about a third were pro-independence, and about a third just wanted to be left alone altogether. The Civil War was an incredibly complicated thing, and people fought different aspects of it for different reasons. And particularly in the North, some were for Union, some were for abolition, some didn't know what we were doing, and then there were a lot of soldiers who were just dragged off the boat from Ireland, given a uniform and told to shoot people. In World War I, the Wilson administration was throwing people in jail left or right for disputing the war. And in World War II, the same thing. I mean, we talk a lot about the Greatest Generation, but a lot of that support was not solidly pro-war. It wasn't solidly anti-Germany. It wasn't solidly anything, really. There's always some disagreement about this stuff. It's only retroactive after it's over that everybody says, oh, well, we came together behind that in one uniform piece.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. There's always rose-tinted glasses when people look back retroactively at these events. And it's always a lot of current regimes that try to drum up these times as being very super patriotic movements that really brought the country together and unified the people in America. And that's very rarely the case, especially when you look back, you know, more recently at the Iraq War, right from the onset, there were people protesting it, but people, again, kind of gloss over that. And they gloss over Carlos Beltran's protesting of the Iraq War. And these people are slowly removed from political memory to create this narrative of extreme patriotism.
Why does that happen? Why do we memorialize only one side in a debate?
It's obviously kind of a tool of the current regime to move forward whatever they're trying to do. And I think for a lot of the population that isn't really invested either way, it's just easier for them to think about single-sided issues than to try and understand the nuances of any given situation. And I think that people largely don't study this stuff anymore. They don't really care about it either way. They don't understand how it still impacts their lives every single day. So it's more just, okay, we'll memorize these like three facts or whatever, and then kind of move on with our actual lives.
Steve here, interrupting to say that although the rise of capitalism is not one of the historical subjects that Mary and I tackle in this episode, here comes an example of what happens when you let it go on unchecked. That's right. We'll be right back after this word from our sponsors. I think you're right. And I think that one of the great ironies to me is that the people who most fear the centrifugal force of immigration and multiculturalism are also the people who do the worst job of teaching our history, when that would be the strongest reinforcement of a through line or an understanding of what being an American is that we have. You can't compel that, but you can make people understand what it is that they're being a part of for all of its nuances. And then you don't have to worry about what their motives for being here are because they've become part of the culture.
Yeah, I strongly believe that history and political history should be taught to everybody in the country in school every single year. It should really kind of be a focus of every single curriculum. And you kind of have society moving away from that now. And you have people focusing on STEM subjects and STEM careers because that's how they think that they will advance their own lives or advance society. And there's this divorce from the country's history. And people kind of look at that as saying that, oh, no, that's in the past. So, like, that's fine. We, like, know that it happened and then that's enough for us. And you need really to investigate these issues and you need to gain critical thinking from that. And that's going to help you make sense of all of these current issues that are happening. It's going to help you understand what these athletes are protesting. It's going to help you understand how immigration actually works and how people come together as a country and how homogeneous populations are often detrimental and heterogeneity is a positive and how the American identity has changed over time and why that's a good thing and why we need to kind of move forward and apply this critical thought to issues in the future.
I've always hated the idea of my country right or wrong. G.K. Chesterton, the great British writer's comeback to that, which is saying my country right or wrong is like saying my mother drunk or sober. And nobody would actually say that in their real life. You wouldn't say that about your dog or your cat, my dog or cat right or wrong. So if, you know, they go on the rug, my dog right or wrong, why shouldn't it just be my country should be right and you work towards that and that the ultimate loyalty is in questioning bad decisions and for that matter, questioning every decision period until it has survived the test of being examined. And that's what these players are asking us to do. But it's an act of empathy that seems to be beyond most people to say, well, could it be that they're not just trying to annoy us or bother us on football Sunday or during a baseball game? Possibly they have a point.
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. It kind of goes into Joe Madden's statements about how we have to respect the offices of the president because they're the president of this great country, et cetera, et cetera. Even though that's not the purpose of the president was never designed to garner blind patriotism. It was always supposed to be somebody the people could hold in check and then in turn could hold the people in check and hold the other branches in check. So we've kind of really lost this idea of checks and balances and of questioning every sort of decision that the government is making and that we as citizens are making. And I think that it's really destructive and it's a huge detriment to not have that anymore.
I'm glad you brought up that piece because I wanted to ask you about it. This is also at Beyond the Box Score. Joe Madden, Donald Trump, and contemporary baseball politics. You wrote, this degradation of the political system is most apparent in the responses to the Obama and Trump presidency. Those who oppose Obama did so ferociously, accusing him of being anti-American, literally un-American, and determined to destroy the country. Now when they are faced with a man who happens to represent their party, they flock to his defense, asserting that the president should receive blind support simply because he is the president. Here's my question about that, and on Joe Madden also. There is a tribalism to sports. That is what makes people, I think in many cases, fans of a team, and they really do feel my team right or wrong. And I'm sure you have a favorite team. I don't at this stage of my life, actually, but I grew up a Yankees fan. I do wonder if there's something inherent about being a sports fan or particularly a team fan that these same kind of political disputes operate on.
I think there is. I'm a Red Sox fan. There's definitely a lot of that within Red Sox fandom where it becomes everything from New York is bad and terrible and wrong, and everything from New England except for Connecticut is correct and a paradigm of virtue. So I think there is something kind of inherent in sports, but I think it goes beyond sports and it just speaks to human nature and to how people like to see the world as black and white. They don't like to complicate things and they like to believe that there's a simple answer for everything and that they can always justified their actions and their beliefs in opposition to X over here. And again, I think it's another issue with the current political system where we have a two-party system by and large. That was never supposed to happen. Many of the founders thought that that would be destructive to the political system because it leads people to this blind sort of patriotism and to a failure to really think critically about everything that they support and everything that they involve. And you do see that turned around in sports where people, as much as they question, you know, the decisions of their managers or as much as they hate a couple players on their team, at the end of the day, it's okay, my team is good, inherently good, and the opposition is inherently bad.
So how do we combat that? Because now what we're talking about is really kind of a flaw in the human mind, this kind of primitive brain thing that creates these adhesions to, I don't know, to units or to tribes or groups. And so on one hand, we're kind of saying, hey, we're all going to go to the bar together and watch the Red Sox win a game. You know, now they're about to go into the playoffs. So, you know, we're going to go watch the Red Sox win the division series against whoever they end up playing. And then on the other, we're saying, but by the way, you have to think about it in a more complex fashion about issues outside of that.
I think it really begins, again, with schooling and with an introduction or a reintroduction of the social sciences, with people learning from a very early age how to think critically about issues so that they're not just following along with whatever they're told to do. You know, that kind of continues into adulthood where they have one party that they're always going to support. They have one team that they're always going to support. So as soon as you kind of open up people, and as early as you can open up people to the idea that issues are nuanced and that there is really no such thing, or I mean, in most cases, because obviously like Nazis are just, you know, 100% bad.
I think we agree that the Nazis are the great exception to the rule of complexity and even-handedness.
Yes, I would like to think that most people are on the same page as us, but that's really kind of becoming questionable at this point in time.
Sadly.
So I think that you just really need to drill home the idea that there are nuances, there are shades to every single person, there are shades to every single event, and that you kind of have to pick through these things and you have to let go of your biases in order to do that.
I hope that's true. I do think in my life I've observed a great lack of critical thinking skills on the part of people. And of course, like all people, I selectively lose mine in certain confused instances because life is hard and emotion gets in the way. But I worry that the idea that we can kind of tell people like, hey, you know, when you put on your Red Sox jersey and root, that's for fun. But when you put on your Make America Great Again cap, it's not the same thing. And I think we treat it as the same thing, or a lot of people treat it as the same thing. But that differentiation between this is your imaginary life and this is your real life has to be underscored for people.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. But I also think that you need to show these fans of these sports teams what they're actually rooting for. You need to show Red Sox fans that for decades, the organization built itself on the image of a man who was incredibly racist and who held back the success of the organization. You have to show them that when they put on that Red Sox hat, that's also what they're parading around. That's also a belief that they're inherently supporting. And so you have to kind of demonstrate that sports are political, that politics influence every sort of element of these teams. And you have to say that you just have to make people aware that sports really aren't separate and that you can have people who are loyal to these teams while understanding their flaws and while working to make their teams better, to make them less racist, to make them more morally inclusive.
I know this is a naive question, and this is more, I think, a matter of opinion than anything else, but is there not a cutoff for that, but a way where you can wear that Red Sox cap and be at peace with that history, but say, I am here in 2017, I'm wearing that Red Sox cap? Because look, I agree with you completely. One of the more bizarre inclusions in the Hall of Fame is Tom Yawkey, who was a racist through and through, who had Jackie Robinson audition for his team and threw him out of Fenway Park, never contacted him again, didn't integrate until 12 years after Jackie Robinson, and then only reluctantly, and really hurt that organization. The curse of the Bambino was not the curse of the Bambino. It was the curse of Tom Yawkey. And by the way, people forget that he wanted to blow up Fenway Park and get a concrete ashtray stadium like everybody else had in the 60s and 70s and threatened to move the Red Sox out of Boston if he didn't get his way. So he offered very little to that franchise other than cash, as far as I'm concerned. But he's also been dead for 40 years, and the Red Sox have certainly had many great players, whether African-American or from the Dominican or other people of color. So the question is, how do we come to terms with rooting for a team in the here and now? And this is true of all 16 original teams. And how do we, at the same time, not dishonor the memory of those people who were injured and excluded by those teams?
It's a very kind of delicate thing to balance, because most fans just kind of live in the heat of the moment, and then they build up David Ortiz, they kind of hero worship him. And so people don't really think about what having David Ortiz on the Red Sox actually means, and how that is an advancement of history. So I think it might start with a few select fans demanding more from the organization, and then the organization in turn not kind of going back through history and shaming fans for not knowing it, but finding this balance where the history of the organization is on display, and it is there for fans to know, but the present and then the progress the team has made to date is also on display. So I think if you're specifically talking about the Red Sox, renaming Yawkey Way in honor of Pumpsy Green kind of really promotes that idea that, yes, the team was racist, but we're not going to recognize the racists. We're going to recognize the people that played for the Red Sox in spite of this racism. And that kind of brings together the present with the past in a way that is more kind of palatable for current fans, but still displays the truth of the organization.
I would like to see that. I mean, we have the Hall of Fame that acknowledges these things. We have the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City, but I don't know if we have, in all the ballparks of these teams, places where they say, look, we were part of a really regrettable era. We would like to acknowledge that and say that that's not who we are now. And, you know, at different places in this country, we do have that, whether it's about slavery or whether it's about the Japanese internment or whether it's about Wounded Knee. We do acknowledge the places where we egregiously screwed up. And I think that these teams, and renaming Yawkey Way is one great gesture. I agree with you. I would like to see that with the Yankees. I would like to see that with all those original teams.
I agree with you. That's definitely important for every team to kind of recognize this spotty history of these individual teams and of professional baseball as a whole, and to put it where fans can see it, where fans can internalize it. And then that in turn will lead fans to have a deeper understanding of their own fandom, of how they fit into the team's history, and of the direction they want these teams to go in the future.
This is something I struggle with, sort of where to draw the line on these things. And I've had Jewish friends and family members say to me, for example, don't buy a Krupp's coffee maker, or don't use something by IG Farben or whatever. These are companies that supported the Nazis. And obviously, German corporate culture was greatly implicated in the rise of Hitler and supported him monetarily in other ways. And I accept that that's real. And I think that would be a meaningful gesture in 1945. I'm not sure if now it's a meaningful gesture to not buy a Krupp's coffee maker, because the people who made those decisions are dead and their children are probably dead. And it's not the same thing, except that maybe psychologically you don't want to look at the word Krupp's in your kitchen every day. I don't know if there's an exact question here. I'm just saying that this is kind of a similar thing. Like if you wear this paraphernalia, and guess what? That goes to the flag too, right? I mean, It embodies everything that flag is waved over, and it's waved over the war on the Philippine insurgents, and it's waved over, again, Wounded Knee, and it's waved over those Japanese internment camps. So you're assuming every instance of it, not just the parts you like.
That's definitely a good point, and it's something that I kind of struggle with a lot I think it's really maybe up to these companies to also kind of recognize their past. Maybe not dwell on it so much, but to understand their roots and to become more actively involved in ensuring that Nazism won't happen again, in donating to memorials for Jewish people killed in the Holocaust, or doing something like that to kind of further civil rights and to rehabilitate the image of these companies that were involved in such despicable acts in the past.
I think given where we are in the United States right now, I could do without the further memorials, and maybe they could give money to educational courses that will teach people that not only were the Nazis fervent racists, that racism is wrong, but they were also among some of the stupidest people ever to walk the earth. I mean, that was not a well-run country. Even if you put aside all the terrible stuff that they did, they were the most dysfunctional, bizarre Byzantine government that has ever existed on the earth, and we can all be thankful for it because it went a long way to why they lost the war.
As you know, I'm a huge proponent of education, and it would certainly help me out if you got students into my classroom who understood these issues more thoroughly than they currently do. So I would totally support that.
Are you doing any teaching right now as part of your graduate work, TAing for classes and so forth?
Yep, I'm TAing, and then I'll be teaching next semester and then for the rest of my time in grad school.
And how prepared do you find that the current generation, and I'm not trying to belittle you at all by saying they're probably not that much younger than you are in many instances, but how prepared do you feel like they are when you see them come into a classroom?
There's kind of a huge dichotomy between them. You have these students who really know their thing, and mostly of what I work with is a mandatory course on the American Constitution. So you have people who are really enthusiastic about that, who have learned about it in high school and really absorbed it. And then you have people coming in who have never read a single word of it.
Great.
Which is, yeah, it's disheartening. And of course, those people kind of already have their views cemented. They're like, I love the Second Amendment, and you're not going to get me to say otherwise. So it's kind of a struggle to really balance those two types of people and to find a way to make the course interesting and accessible to people from all different levels of understanding.
Before we get back to baseball and politics and the intersection thereof, I do want to ask, since you're studying the American founding and you brought up the Second Amendment too, is it hard to make people understand that whereas a lot of Supreme Court justices and other people like to look at the text of that document and refer to the intent of the framers, that there were many different framers, they were not of one mind, and it is very hard at this great distance to intuit their intent when they themselves at that moment had no agreement whatsoever on what their intent was?
It's definitely a difficult thing, and it kind of goes back to the idea that people don't like to look at the nuances of a situation because it makes it too difficult for them to learn about things. You kind of have to really hammer home the idea that it's the founding fathers, plural, there were a ton of them, and they often fell into conflict. But I think kind of the one thing that they sort of agreed on for the most part, and is really embodied in the Constitution, is that it is a document that is designed to change over time through the amendment process or whatever. That's really kind of designed to fit with the times of society, and it's designed to operate in the society that's constantly evolving. So you can look back at their intents and say, oh, well, like, here's what they thought of the Second Amendment. But the big issue is to say, okay, it's not certain that they thought the Second Amendment would last or be useful for this entire length of the history of America. And you really kind of have to look at the Constitution as something that you can mold to current society's needs.
If their intent had been so self-evident, to borrow from another document that they wrote, the Declaration, the Federalist Papers wouldn't have been necessary. Everybody just would have been able to read it and understand exactly what it meant without any need for those three guys, Jay, Hamilton, and Madison, to get in between them and the parchment and explain what it was that they thought it meant.
Yeah, precisely. And you see that a lot in the first decade or two of the Constitution. There was still a lot of debate. And even outside of the founding fathers and in various states and among various people as to what precisely the Constitution meant. So in saying that, people today can say, oh, yes, 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 like I've got this all figured out. You know, the founding fathers themselves had trouble really understanding the exact precise way it could be applied to every element of society.
One of the really revelatory moments for me learning about that is when I first took civics or U.S. history, and this is probably eighth grade or ninth grade. You know, everybody, when you learn about the Constitution, they tell you that Benjamin Franklin was there. They don't tell you that he's very old and didn't speak for himself, like he would write things and then pass them off to somebody else to read. But he had this famous closing statement. And the closing statement, when they were getting ready on as to try to vote on the thing, was to say, and this is from memory, so if I screw this up, please don't give me a C or a D. This Constitution is not perfect, but I hope that with all your flaws, or all its flaws, all your flaws too, he should have said that maybe, that you will put aside your reservations and vote for it, because I've, in my life, learned to doubt myself a little bit. And although it is probably not the best Constitution there could be, it is the best Constitution we could have written. That is the part that gets taught to you. But if you go back and read the actual full text of what he says, there's a but. And the but is, and I don't think it will end in despotism until such time as the people become so corrupt as to require that form of government over any other. And that is a very chilling and pessimistic and shocking statement for him to have made at that moment. But it certainly tells us that he, at least, did not think this was a perfect immutable document.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of founders thought the same thing. You have letters between Madison and Jefferson, Madison, Washington, saying the same thing, that this document and this country will only prosper as long as a vibrant, well-educated populace is there to prop it up, that in and of itself, it cannot operate, and that the true movers of government are the citizens themselves.
And another really useful thing that I don't think we study, and I don't know how much time you've spent on this, but it came to mind when, again, we're talking about statues and about whether Abraham Lincoln was as progressive on race and things like that as we would like him to be today. You had Jefferson write, "All men are created equal." You had John Adams, who was part of the group that drafted that document. We don't know exactly who contributed what or who did the editing. As a writer and editor, I'd like to think that Ben Franklin was in there with his blue pen. There are certain phrases that maybe suggest that. But John Adams, who was out of the country for a lot of the action afterwards, became very unpopular in part because he said, look, it's not true. They're not all created equal. We don't treat them as equally. They're not born with the same abilities, the same opportunities, and we need to be realistic about that. And nobody wanted to hear that at that time because they liked the idea so much. Many years later, Lincoln said, of course it wasn't true, but they put it there for us to use when we were ready to use it. And so even that most basic idea of our founding in the Declaration of Independence, the best words in the whole thing, "We hold these truths that all men are created equal," were not uncontroversial at the time and continued to be controversial for many years thereafter.
And that's kind of an issue with how people view the founders themselves, as this insanely brilliant group of people who just kind of came down onto earth to draft this single document, when in reality they were very much kind of a product of their time. And while they were brilliant, while they were learned, they, like everybody else, can't escape the time in which they're living. And so they were having kind of the same debates that have extended throughout the history of America about this document. And they themselves, first off, didn't want people to worship them in the way that we currently worship them. They were very much aware that they were just, you know, a group of men who were coming together to do this one thing. And so I think they would very much be appalled by the fact that we have statues to them. You know, some of them are kind of chiseled into the side of a mountain. They would not be on board with that. And it really is, again, a product of the fact that people like to learn easy history. They like to cling on to the cherry tree stories. They like to know that these men had these, you know, two qualities that they stuck with them throughout the rest of their, throughout like their entire lives. When that really wasn't the case for them, it wasn't the case for America at the time. I mean, it certainly isn't the case now.
I still like 1776, though, Mary. I like the Declaration of Independence musical. I don't want to let go of that.
I mean, that's fine. I love that stuff, too. You can consume it while also understanding that it's not the whole story.
No. Well, for one thing, they didn't sing quite that much, I don't think, in real life.
No, it wasn't in Madison's. No, it was in the convention, so... So.
Right. Well, no, that's it. We haven't gotten the 1787 musical yet. That was just 1776. If there's going to be a 1787 musical, I don't know that anybody's clamoring for that, but I think you and I are going to have to write that one.
I would very much be. I'll just submit that as my dissertation. And I'll love it.
Before we close this out, since we're coming up on an hour, I do want to ask, what kind of reaction have these pieces of yours gotten? Because they're very strident. And I think they're very right. But again, they're not the kind of thing that maybe people click over to Beyond the Box Score for, or BP. Although I noticed BP, you dwell more on the lighter side of things and are less political there. But again, normally people don't like it when we delve into politics. And when I was at BP, I got yelled at a lot for doing some of the same stuff you're doing on the thesis that I would automatically alienate half the readers. And I've actually heard that about this podcast, too. That I would automatically lose about half the people if I gave opinions on one political issue or another. So I'm curious how your work has been received and if you have had to deflect a lot of hostility.
I've definitely had a number of people tell me that I am single-handedly ruining Beyond the Box Score, which I take as a compliment. That's kind of been the biggest thing. A lot of people have told me distinctive sports, which I think is hilarious because it's not often that women are told to do that. So there's a lot of kind of mixed signals going on, but I've also received a lot of positive feedback and a lot of people have told me that these pieces have really resonated with them, have really changed the way they understand the relationship between sports and politics. So I like to think that they're doing, you know, at least a little bit of good. I did have at least a dozen people tell me that they will no longer visit the sites for which I write. And one of my pieces that I wrote on Joe Madden, some people got so angry at that they started tweeting at BP Wrigleyville, which I also write for, telling me that they were no longer going to read that site either and telling them that they kind of need to rein me in a little bit because I was writing inappropriate things about the team.
Okay, so first of all, how can you be told to stick to sports? Not that anybody should be told that, but you never did. You emerged writing about these topics from the get-go, and your biography on these sites says, Mary Craig writes about the intersection of sports and politics. So it's like asking me to stick to pro bowling. I've never done that. So what, you know, why ask that? But second of all, is it that Madden is such a sacred cow that he's beyond criticism at this point?
For the first point, yeah, it's very weird. I've never made it known that I would ever stick to sports, you know, whatever they mean by that. That's just not what I do. I don't think I've ever written a piece that's contained numbers aside from dates and a couple of batting averages here and there. That's just not what I do. There are plenty of other fantastic people out there that do them. So if you're looking for that, then, and you click on my piece, like, you've already made a bad choice. Like, it's very clear. Like, whenever my name pops up, like, if you're going to, like, want to look at the MVP race, like, don't click on my stuff. It's not going to be in there.
As far as criticizing Joe Madden, is it that he's such a sacred cow that he's considered beyond criticism at this point?
It's definitely partially that, because he delivered them their first World Series victory in 108 years. But he's also, like, very sacred and worshipped wherever he goes. And I think that might have to do with the persona that he puts out about being this, like, weird, cool, quirky guy that I personally have never bought into. But fans of his teams seem to really appreciate. And I also just think it's again, people being uncomfortable with being critical of these ideas that have been assumed as kind of the norm in America. And so a lot of people, whatever Joe Madden has said, kind of take it as the truth, take it as face value, and they don't want to investigate it. And they don't want to find out that maybe they think the same way and therefore there are problems with the way that they understand America. So kind of when I needle him, they get very defensive over both him and their own political views.
Here's the thing that I think people miss, and we talked about this a good deal earlier when it came to trying to figure out what it is that you are embracing when you wear the Red Sox cap. And is it the whole legacy or just like the last 10 minutes? The difficult part is it's not totally your choice, and that symbology reads differently to different people. and that you're kind of doing an editing job on things if you just pretend it's the last 10 minutes. I had a friend years ago. This is the one area I think is my third rail. I'm not going to get heavily into religion here, so don't worry about that. But years ago, she changed religion, and she changed from one that was more casual to one that was, let's say, more strict about certain things. And I said, but you're pro-choice. And she said, yeah. And I said, and you support gay rights. And she said, yeah. I, you know, listed all these other things that this new religion that she was going to supported. And she said, yeah, well, those are not the parts that I like. I like the liturgy. And I like the costumes and I like these other rituals. And so I'm just choosing to ignore that stuff. And it seems to me that you can't do that any more that you can wear a Confederate flag because you just like the color scheme, or for that matter, put on the Red Sox cap and say, yeah, but the pre-1959 Pumpsy Green era is not something that I am taking any responsibility for. So that goes to Joe Madden too. And it goes to the current political situation that there's a tacit endorsement. If you're going to go to the White House, you may not think there is, but there is. And you're saying, I'm going to participate in this as if it was normal and okay and everything is great. And you may not be explicitly saying, well, you know, I support the president when he says there are good people on both sides of a pro and anti-Nazi rally, but that's the effect of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely what I think as well, that people largely don't want to understand nuances until they're accused of being a bigot. And then they say, oh, whoa, 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 like, wait a minute, like, you're the bigot here calling me a bigot, or you're the racist, you know, because you're accusing other people of being racist. And I think that something that there's an essay that Hannah Arendt wrote where she kind of talks about this a little bit, in that people who are maybe, you know, 2-3 generations past the Nazi regime are no longer responsible for what the Nazis did, but they're responsible for ensuring that it will never happen again. And that's their responsibility. So they're not to be blamed for these acts. But if they don't move forward in a way that ensures that these acts will never happen again, then they bear responsibility for them.
You know, Mary, I started this podcast almost 6 months ago. This is the third time that Hannah Arendt has come up. I never knew I would have the one baseball podcast in which Hannah Arendt was a recurring subject. I'm sure this is the way to great success and wealth for me, but I'm pleased. It shows that I have very well-read guests and that we're touching on a number of areas. And this is the thing, like, sports is everything. Everything is sports, and you can very easily go from baseball to the trial of Adolf Eichmann without trying too hard.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, you don't need to try and kind of draw these giant webs to connect sports to politics when they've both existed for as long as they've done. And I'm actually reading Thucydides for a class now. And he talks a lot about how even during these wars, people still stopped to play the Olympics. And one of the big turning points of the wars was when Sparta was denied entry to the Olympics during one of the years. And then Sparta kind of rallied from that because it was just such a bold move and such a something that ordinarily would have been condemned by all parties. And so that kind of really showed how sports and politics really have always been mixed in society.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Mary, I greatly thank you for doing this. It was fantastically educational for me, and hopefully we won't have too many more protests where it will be incredibly topical for us to talk, but I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yes, thank you for having me.
By the hippie hippie shake, we've reached the end of another episode. You can follow Mary Craig on Twitter at Mary M. Craig. Wonder what that stands for. And you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Well, the G-O stands for Garrulous Orangutan, which is somehow what I was voted after I was nominated for Prom King. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com, and I promise I will return your email. I'm slowly working through the bunch that we've gotten. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 41. Our producer, in a very emotional scene, recently revealed to me that he is not actually a human being, but a snake named Randall, who can neither hear what we are saying nor reach the controls. It explains so much, but I don't want to let him go. That would be snakeist. Our theme song, which you are listening to now and have in fact been listening to throughout the episode, was co-authored by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. And here is my personal message to him. Rick, I know where the stuffed fish is. It escaped the fire last time, but it's going in. You need to reveal it, take it to Andy's fire pit, and we should burn it while dancing and singing Glory Hallelujah. Well, speaking of fish, given that I'm incapable of cooking anything at all, they've told me I'm not a good enough chef to prepare fugu in my own kitchen, but I read somewhere online, a reliable site, that its toxicity had been greatly exaggerated, so I'm gonna give that a shot. And if I survive that, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the infinite inning.